Sure. I had established, I've wanted to do a dance. Okay. I have wanted to do a dance film for some time. The dance genre, the whole concept of that style of film was intriguing to me because I've always used music in my work, and the challenge of taking music and movement is to me something that I had ambitions towards in terms of film. But I didn't want to explore the traditional dance genre of either adapting a Broadway show or taking some plot that was a vague excuse to put string dances together.
Like Don Ameche and John Payne and those Fox musicals.
Right. In any event, I the films that I have done so far have all been narrative stories with strong acting roles in them, and I wanted to continue that tradition and at the same time deal with dance in a non-performance setting. Because I feel that dance films in the past have always had, as brilliant as the dance may be, you know, when someone dances, it stops the dramatic action. Everything stops flat, and you watch the performance, and then if there is any kind of continuity, you've got to fight the inertia and build it up after that. So the idea was to take a narrative form with dance in a non-performance setting. And then I had to make a choice of whether I was going to cast actors and double them with dancers, which has happened in recent past, or to, cast great dancers and get acting performances from them. And I went for the latter. So then I went to Bryshkov and Hines, and that brings you up to where we started. Once I had enlisted their support, I then went out and talked to a number of writers and tried to plug in my philosophy, the kind of film I wanted to make, number one. And number two, I tried to get them to relate a story to the strengths of Hines and Bryshkov. I mean, they're two unique individuals. One's Russian, a ballet dancer, has a certain intensity as a man. Hines has the same intensity, black, American tap dancer. You're not going to make them something that they're not. I mean, I wasn't going to make one a cowboy, another an astronaut. I wanted there to be roles that fit them as individuals. And I did talk to a lot of different writers. James Goldman, who wrote Lion and Winter, came up with a concept for White Knights, which I thought fit the criteria that I'd set forward for him, which was the philosophy, the roles, the contemporary context. And I took the idea to Bryshkov and Hines. They liked it, and that's how the project came about. The interesting thing is, I mean, that this film was designed for them specifically. They had input into every draft of the script. There were three different writers, Goldman, Eric Hughes, and Nancy Dowd finished the script. And each time these men had, I mean, what I did, I spent a lot of time with them, talking with them and trying to discern their unique characteristics and worked some of that into the script, into each draft we had, so that the Bryshkov character, although this has never happened to him, it's a hypothetical situation. The character is not unlike himself, obviously. And likewise with Hines, his early frustrations as a tap dancer, the novelty act, and all those things, we tried to incorporate also.
Now, supposedly, Bryshnikov has objected to doing a story of his life, but yet here we have a film in which there are enough parallels to make us wonder, did something change his mind? Did he express reservations to you at any time?
Well, he has refused consistently to do a story of his defection. In other words, how I defected, what my life was, and so forth. What I did was I turned it around. I went to him and said, you know, we're going to take a character not unlike yourself, but that's when the film begins. We're going to go into a completely hypothetical situation, you know, where you've never experienced it. Maybe you never will, hopefully not. But I certainly think you've thought about it, maybe had a few nightmares about it.
Especially when he's on tour.
Right. A smile crossed his face as I said it. But in reality, it came down to me saying, I think, you know, he wants to be an actor. And he is willing, you know, as great a dancer as he is, he knows he didn't get there by just natural talent. He worked very hard. And he has a respect for the acting profession and has a desire to work at it and to really accomplish something. And as such, he was great to work with because he came in completely open and serious about what he was doing. But I said to him, I felt that he needed to have a role that was close to who he is so that he could really dig inside himself and deal with these emotions that I thought would be provocative to see on camera. And, you know, actually thinking about like a world-class athlete, you know, I mean, Muhammad Ali, you know, or someone like this who, you know, we know is brilliant at what he does, but here he is in a dramatic movie, which has real correlations to his own life, dealing with things that are very difficult for him to deal with. That was designed.
There's a telling line. It almost goes by too fast, where he's telling Hines early on in the film, as bad as it is here, it's still better in America. So there's like a personal viewpoint kind of coming through in some of that dialogue.
How much of it did he act as a kind of technical advisor to the film in terms of what would be shown in Russia?
Throughout. He was my ex officio censor in this. I read most of the major books written about Russia in recent history. I mean, the Shipler book, the Kaiser book, the Hedrick Smith book, Harrison Salisbury. I mean, these people who, for the New York Times and the Washington Post, are bureau chiefs in Moscow, usually write books when they finish. And I read them all, which was very interesting, and spent a great deal of time with Russian defectors and immigrants and people from Eastern Europe. So that all that information went into the script. But bottom line is, it is not a character unlike Baryshnikov. And you can't, you know, he's a very strong individual, and he's not about to say something or do something that he doesn't feel is accurate. So all the way through this, I would say, how do you think you would react in this situation? If they put you in this situation, what would you feel? Those types of things. And inevitably, he had a very strong voice in the not only the content, the emotional content, but also the technical side. I mean, he was consistently always picking something up and saying, this doesn't belong here, or I don't think this is accurate, or whatever.
On the emotional side of that, were there moments?
Well, certainly. I mean, the one thing that he did not want to do was do something, specifically tied to his family or his life. But, you know, certainly he left loved ones there. The whole Helen Mirren role of an ex-lover who he had danced with and would been in collaborated with, and leaving without telling her and never thinking he'd have to see her again, and then having to confront her again, an immense emotional thing. Now, how many individuals he built into that character when he was doing the scene, I don't know, but certainly he was going through some very emotionally stressful feelings when he was doing. I mean, just the sense of going back to the stage of the Kirov. I said to him, you walk on stage at the Kirov, how would you feel? He says, I said, what would you say? He said, I couldn't say anything. You know, I'd cry. I mean, the emotion within me would be so intense that it would be a very difficult thing to deal with.
Okay, do you think that since it's professional life of a dancer?
I do, but I think that you can, seeing the film, have a perspective. I think that that he has. See, I have a certain point of view about movie acting and about actors and about stars. Mm-hmm. And I think truly the indelible stars of all time have been those people who are so uniquely riveting that you can't take your eyes off of them. They may not necessarily have gone to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts for 10 years, but they have this presence that the camera loves. And in this film, I took a chance on four basic non-actors. That doesn't mean that they weren't incredibly talented people. They are, but they had not had a great deal of experience in the acting field. But each one of them, I felt, had that kind of unique quality, especially Baryshnikov. I just feel that he has an intensity and a look and a power through his eyes that goes right through that lens and into you as an audience and rivets you. Now, I think that it's crazy not to utilize him as long as he can in a dance situation because the combination of the two is great. But I could definitely think that he could play some roles on his own. He's clearly Russian. He clearly sounds that way. He's not going to drop the accent and become something else. But if utilized in the right context, I think it could be terrific.
Did the State Department suggest to you you hold up release until after the summit meeting?
No.
I mean, seriously. Yes. Of course, I don't know that anyone
just
listens.
So either accept that the one thing that has been expressed to me by certain writers upon seeing the film is they don't think that a film is accurate, that kind of situation could occur. And I freely say that the film is hypothetical. But it was important to substantiate that I didn't just, I mean, James Goldman, who wrote the story, I didn't write the story, but I felt it was important to kind of check. And if you're going to do a hypothetical story, you try to base it as much in fact as possible. And for people to say, oh, well, I don't think they would react like this, or, the KGB would, You know, from everything I can find out about the KGB, the way Jersey comports himself, which is a very charming, very offhanded way. He doesn't directly say, you know, hold a gun to somebody's head and say this. If you notice, I mean, Jersey never makes a direct proposal. I mean, he uses Hines in that kind of obtuse way and, you know, manipulates beautifully and is a great gamesman.
But he's also a racist and a sexist.
I have to say that I think that Russian society is incredibly racist. Everything that I've been able to read from people there, I would say that, I certainly think that Russian society is as racist as American society, and I think that's pretty intense. But I also think that we're dealing with somebody who's a KGB officer. I mean, these are the keepers of the flame. They are also the most privileged members of Russian society. They are able to travel freely throughout the world. I mean, you know, the statement about seeing West Side Story, the original cast, and so forth. I mean, that's a fact of life. People speak several languages. They dress in English suits. They smoke American cigarettes. They have all the privileges that people in that society may not have. I think a point could be made about most males having certain sexist ideology and most whites having, not most whites, but I would not like to think most whites, but certainly a great many of them having certain racist, characteristics. And inevitably in Russia where there is not, I mean, there's a lot of ethnic diversity within Russia. And if you really study Russia and down to the point, you know, the people around Moscow have incredible prejudices about anybody who's not from that kind of area of Russia. So that the Georgians, I mean, you know, it's like listening to Polish jokes when they talk about Georgians, you know. People from other parts of Russia, so much less people from, you know, other ethnic areas. So, frankly, I have to stand by the statements made in the film that, you know, on the other hand, you know, when Helen Mirren represents an artist and a Russian and a person who I think has a lot of humanity in her, Isabella Rossellini portrays a, quote, Russian who has a lot of humanity in her. So, yes, Jersey represents one facet, and other people represent others. He has the official capacity, and so therefore that statement is made. But, you know, listen, the film, I think, is about the need for artistic and individual freedom. And I think societies can be judged by the amount of freedom they give their artists, their writers, their creative people. And the Soviet Union has not been particularly exemplary in that area.
Yeah, well, was there any...
I think that in terms of individuals, I mean, I can talk about Jersey being racist, but I mean, in terms of individuals and within a system, I don't think that you can ever characterize any of those people. I mean, especially somebody who, she's an interpreter and fairly international in her scope and enlightened in her perspective. But no, I mean, you know, inevitably, in that instance, there are very few black people in Russia, usually Russian exchange students, and I think that the unique quality of this man and who he was and so forth makes it certainly possible, and you know, inevitably it is a hypothetical story, but you know, one then evaluates the facts and makes your choices and put it up on the screen.
The frequent use of rock music on the cassettes in the dance sequences, is that kind of music regarded over there as being somehow subversive or decadent or whatever adjective you want to apply?
Yes.
As a person involved in that kind of music in your films,
I think that is there rock and roll in Russia? Yes. Is there free access to the evolution of current popular culture? No. Occasionally, I mean, Elton John did a concert in Moscow, so you know, you can't say that there haven't been pop artists who have gone there and performed. Yes, that has happened. However, in terms of the expansiveness of that and the free accessibility and exchange, I don't think there's that much. I mean, I talked to Misha about, you know, what he was talking about being in Russia, and when anybody, one of his friends, an artist or a musician, or anyone went on tour, I mean, the whole concept was to rush up and find them as soon as they got back. You know, did they bring any records back? Did they see anything? What was happening? Somebody would bring back in a tape and, you know, of some jazz artist, and they'd all kind of sit around the living room like this, just listening, you know, like soaking it up, communing, listening to John Coltrane. I mean, it was like this amazing thing for them.
Well, Hines' reaction to the music, he says, "This is so complex, I can't quite get it."
Yeah. Well, I don't think he couldn't quite get it.
He says it.
Yeah. I have experimented with music in my films in terms of using contemporary music within the context of dramatic films. And in this instance, I was designing a soundtrack to do things more than just play music in the background. And in this way, music is kind of a catalyst in the film. Since Hines has been away for 10 years and been away from that culture, when he hears the music, it has it just does a lot of things. It makes him realize the time that's been missed, reevaluates his decision, rediscovers his cultural roots, and just makes him think a little bit about home, which starts the whole thing going. I mean, Baryshnikov falls out of the sky and creates this sense of reevaluation for Hines in his life.
I spoke with Alvin Ailey recently, and he said that ballets of his, like The River, are censored in the Soviet Union. He cannot perform them there because of the jazz elements and all of that.
Right. Well, you know, the opening dance in this film, Le Genome et l'Amour, which was designed by Jean Cocteau and choreographed by Roland Petit in 1947, has never been performed in Russia, even though Petit's work has been done in Russia, but only the most conservative parts of his work. And it has not been performed there. It has been labeled as decadent. And the reason to start the film, for a number of reasons with that piece, but also specifically, is that you see Baryshnikov dancing a ballet in the West that he could not perform in Russia. And the fact that the material presages some of what's going to happen later is also important. But it was there for a reason.
Could you say a little bit something about your choice?
When Goldman's story was told to me by him, I thought it was particularly interesting and provocative in a Kafkaesque type way of this guy having to go back and reconfront his past. And I went to Leningrad because I wanted to research and soak up as much of Russia as possible. And I realized I was in deep trouble when I went there because it is a totally unique city, unlike any other in the world, and not replicable in Western Europe or any place in the West. And Reds and Gorky Park have applied for permission and failed to be able to shoot in Russia. And obviously, I knew I couldn't shoot in Russia. I mean, you know, the context of this film is true. Baryshnikov cannot go back there. Defection is considered a crime. But when I saw it, I realized I was going to be very bad shape in terms of the look of this film unless I did something. And so I made up my mind to, through hook or crook, get footage of Russia. And did. I won't tell you how. What do you mean, the basic house? In Siberia?
Near the Kirov.
Let's put it this way. I shot a lot of really high quality, I didn't shoot, but I had shot for me, a lot of high quality 35mm footage of Leningrad. And you see the exterior of the Kirov, that is the Kirov. When you see those thousands of people on the street of Nevsky Prospect, which is the major street, that is it. The interior of the Kirov was done in the San Carlo Opera House in Lisbon, Portugal. Now, interesting thing about that was that Misha, he said a number of things. I mean, when I first told him I was going to get footage of Leningrad, he said, no way, never in a million years, I'll never allow it, you'll never get it, so forget it. And I said, I'm going to try. And when I came back with the footage, which we had before I shot, I designed the film around that footage. I transferred to videotape, and I brought him into the room. I said, I want you to see something. And I set him down in front of a monitor, and he just speechless, sat there for an hour and a half without saying a word, just looking at this footage. I had shot his apartment house where he had lived, and he just couldn't believe it. I mean, so the same thing happened when we talked about the Kirov. He says, "Well, now you got the exterior, but there's no theater that is the Mariansky Theater, where the Kirov is. It has a unique look inside." Well, we looked and looked and looked, and ended up by choosing Portugal, and it has a very similar architectural look with the individual boxes, the royal box at the back. The Kirov is white, gold, and a very pale blue. And the San Carlo is white, gold, with a very pale pink. And that was the only difference. But, I mean, he was amazed. He walked in that theater and just shook his head and said, and it's interesting because, as I said, if he ever got back on the stage of the Kirov, what would happen? And he had to, in that scene where he kind of has that farewell, the second time of leaving Russia and looking at the stage, he had to really feel the Kirov there. He really had to feel that auditorium. And it was a nice moment for him.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I must say, one of the reasons that I was able to, see them a lot was that I was preparing the film, but a thing I liked about what Misha's done with the ABT is that he's not, it used to be concentrating on stars and great people like that, and now what he's been able to do is develop a group of dancers that have been terrific, and I think there's great quality. Yeah, I really went to the City Ballet when Balanchine was there and saw that, and anyway,
Was his partner in the...